Welcome to the MedTech Talent Lab, the number one catalyst for advancing careers and building high-performance teams. Sponsored by the Anthony Michael Group, helping companies secure in-demand talent in regulatory affairs, quality, clinical, engineering, R&D, and other areas for medical device, digital health, diagnostics, and other organizations across the U.S. life sciences sector. Here's your host, Mitch Robbins.
All right, welcome back to another episode here on the MedTech Talent Lab podcast. It's Mitch Robbins, and today I am thrilled to have with me Dr. Greg Critchfield. Gregory has served our industry for over 30 years, and as president, he was instrumental in building Myriad Genetic Laboratories into one of the world's leading molecular diagnostic companies. He also served as chairman and CEO of a company called Sarah Prognostics, a women's health company focused on preterm and other pregnancy indications, where he led fundraising of more than $300 million between both venture and IPO funding. He still serves on the board of that organization today. Currently, Dr. Critchfield serves as co-CEO as well of a company, Early Diagnostics, a company with world-class early detection of multiple cancers. He has his bachelor's degree in microbiology from Brigham Young University. He received his MD from the University of Utah, and also his master's degree in biophysical sciences from the University of Minnesota. In 2021, he earned the Entrepreneur of the Year Award from BioUtah. As if this wasn't enough, Dr. Critchfield serves as an adjunct faculty member on the board of the Center for Medical Innovation at the University of Utah, and as a trustee of Bear Lake Watch, which is a nonprofit organization protecting the color, clarity, depth of Bear Lake, which spans between Utah and Idaho. Now, earlier this year in 2024, Dr. Critchfield was the recipient of the Governor's Medal for Science and Technology at the One Utah Summit. Hey, without further ado, Greg, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mitch. Great to be here.
I'm so thrilled that you're here. I know it's been a couple weeks in the making, but really this is going to be a great episode. And what we're going to talk about is just really your experience here building very successful organizations throughout your years of experience. We're going to talk a little bit more at the end about the nonprofit that I know you're very passionate about. But there's so many things I want to dig into. And I think first and foremost, the thing is, how did this all start, Greg? How did you take an interest into the med tech and greater life sciences industry in the first place?
In my early life, my father was a family doctor. Okay. And I remember talking to him one day and saying, what's the most difficult thing that you do? And he told me, he says, it's making a diagnosis. He said, the treatments are fairly well prescribed. You go off and do them and you're okay. But the real problem is figuring out what's going on with patients. I never forgot that. I had a tremendous interest in science and mathematics. I decided that I would really get into the world of diagnosis and information, because I knew that was going to become a big deal in healthcare and in our society, which it has become today. I've been fortunate to be able to participate in a couple of revolutions of our understanding. Genomics was one of the first ones. Then you go to proteomics, the expression of genes, and ultimately epigenomics now, with ways of turning genes on and off and actually predicting diseases and conditions. All these things are about understanding better what's going on. Because at the end of the day, what we really want to do is build things that make human life better. That's what it's all about.
100%. And so I want to go back real quick. You mentioned your dad as a physician. Did you grow up in Utah?
I've never grown up, and I'm not planning on growing up. So, but yes, I spent my early years in Utah, and that is where I went to school, and then two universities, and then ultimately left Utah for a number of years to go out and into other areas around the country.
And what about your family life? Do you have siblings?
I do. I have three sisters and one brother, all younger than me.
Wow, so five of you.
Yeah.
Okay, you're the oldest.
That's right.
That's awesome. I'm the oldest of three boys, where there's three of us. You mentioned that you've always been interested in science, even from a young age.
Yeah, I used to read science fiction, and I love stories about the future, and love to try and imagine what it would be like. And to me, I've always been convinced that we are able to create a better tomorrow by doing things today. I have a firm belief in that. And in fact, if you look at the progress that's been made in medicine over the last several decades, we've seen some extraordinary things. It's not over with. It's an exciting time to be alive, to be able to participate, and to figure out ways to improve human health. It's a passion.
That's awesome. And, you know, I feel like there's so much, I'm a little overwhelmed because I feel like you've got such a great story and there's so many pieces that I want to dig into. I'm thinking about your time at Myriad and how you guys just built that into what a success it was. What takeaways have you taken with you from that time going forward as you lead these other companies?
Well, I think that it was a great experience for me. I joined Myriad in 1998 as president of the diagnostic division of Myriad. Myriad was actually a biotech company that had aspirations to be a pharmaceutical company. And we had two divisions. One was pharmaceutical, the other was diagnostic. And the idea was to discover genes in the early days, cause cancer, and then to commercialize the genes. And from that, develop proceeds that help fund research to ultimately become a pharma company. As it turned out, the diagnostic company grew very, very rapidly. We had 54% growth for 12 years in a row. It was a huge success. And ultimately, Myriad spun the pharma part out and became a pure play diagnostic company. What I learned there was that the people that you surround yourself with matter immensely. You have to find the right people. You have to find people that share the vision, that want to improve health. You have to find people who are unrelenting in figuring out ways to make things better. And you can always find people that will say, oh, you can't do this or you can't do that. It's really easy to be negative and say, this can't do it. What you really need to be successful is to find people that can find the way to get it done and to move you along. So that's something I really learned while I was there, working with a tremendous cadre of people there, you know?
And I'm sure you were instrumental in helping build that team. What do you look for when you're building a team and you look for people who are, you know, to use your terminology, unrelenting? How do you vet that out?
First of all, you have to do an assessment of what the requirements are in order to achieve your long-term vision. In a diagnostic company, as an example, you want people that have experience on the science side, who can build a solid platform on which you're able to launch products and build them. I actually learned that very, very well from my days at Corning. As a Corning employee working for Corning Clinical Labs, which was spun out in 97 as Quest Diagnostics, one of the board members was a gentleman who taught me. He said, in technology companies, you need a base of technology, but you always launch products off of your base. Have a solid science foundation, and then build products off of that. And so what you look for in these kinds of companies, you look for people that have certain technical skills, people that have experience in building things, people who've been able to work without undue friction in organizations and bringing things forward. You look for elements in their background, and you talk to them about how do you achieve a goal that's difficult? What do you do? How do you bring people on board to help you do that? What kind of team would you be building around you to be successful? Those are the kinds of things that you look for when you interview people. Yeah.
And I want to know more about, you know, I think the phrase that comes to mind is a cabinet, right? You think of a president's cabinet or an executive cabinet in some way. I want to know your philosophy around building your cabinet and kind of the sounding board as a CEO that you're looking for. How do you kind of, in your mind, construct the types of folks that you want around you?
Okay, that's a great question. And this is something you have to always be aware of, because over time, as the company develops, it will be changing. And I'll come back to that in some future thoughts that we'll talk about. What you want, there are certain pieces of expertise that you need. As a CEO, you cannot be a master of all things. You have to have other people that are really good. And you want to hire people that are better than you at doing certain things. On the technical side, there are certain skills that are required based on the technology that you have. You have to have people that have experience in using it and developing it. You try and find people that will be giving you advice based on their past experience. A rich set of experiences are brought in as you form a cabinet from different people. And you want people that don't just say yes, yes, yes all the time. They challenge you. They say, well, this is really hard. I don't know how we can do this. And when you go to them and say, okay, tell me how you would do. What are we lacking in order to get there? And you collaborate with them to solve problems. One of the things that I did, I frequently interviewed my reports almost every week. I touched bases with them and talked to them about what they were doing, figure out what they needed, ask them, and we discuss challenges. But it was very, very collaborative in helping them to build their portion of the business and then get those pieces to complement each other as parts of a puzzle. Yeah.
If you look back, are there certain mistakes that you can point to where you feel like you, in hindsight, made a hiring mistake?
Well, that's really interesting. You have to be self-critical. First of all, when you hire people, it doesn't always work out for one reason or another. You want to have a very high success rate and find the people that are going to work out. That's one thing you want to do. And part of it, I think that part of it is when you hire somebody for a particular set of tasks at a particular job, you want to find the best people you possibly can. You have to look expansively. You can't just have people around you and have somebody knows somebody else and you just do it. You need to think about and open the search out widely to make sure that you're bringing in the best talent that will be germane for what you're trying to solve. Okay, so that's one of the things you do. You also, in building the cabinet, you want to establish a culture where people are not afraid to bring up problems and discuss things. Because if people start hiding things from you, that's where you really get in trouble. And so you make sure you have an open dialogue. If your door is open for people to tell you things that are wrong, they can. One guy that I knew was great. You know, he was the chairman of he was reporting to the chairman of a very large laboratory company, and he would have an appointment with this guy every year, and go in and say, okay, it's my turn to talk. You listen. I'm going to tell you everything that you're doing wrong. He had a good enough rapport to be able to do that, and the chairman / CEO he was talking to was very secure and actually relished that discussion because out of that came some great insights. So you have to establish the ground rules for communication, make sure people can bring problems with you, and then you try and brainstorm, solve the problem, and give them the tools so they can be successful. We all know the thing that matters most to an employee is having the tools to be successful. The worst thing you could do is put somebody in a position where they can't win. And so this idea of winning is important. So when you look for a cabinet around, you want to have that. The cabinet is not solely the people that report to you. Yes, you're building a whole team of people. And it may be some of their reports will at times be interacting with you and helping you to solve problems. And not only that, you have a board that you report to. And I would say that a really good CEO also has people outside of the company entirely that are mentors that advise them, that help them too. So the cabinet is a very broad concept.
Yeah, I love that. There's a couple of takeaways there. One is to be very cognizant to not surround yourself with a bunch of yes people. I think that's where you can get into big trouble. And then two, to foster a culture that allows for that to happen. Because if it's not an open culture where the CEO is not open to feedback and not open to pushback, it can be very hard, even if they aren't yes people, it can be very hard for those people to feel free to express themselves.
That's right. And by the way, some of the pearls or the insights that you get from having somebody tell you about something, they may actually change the direction of what you're doing. because you may learn something that is vital in developing a new product or bringing something to market or addressing a challenge that you're seeing as you're commercializing something. So I think it's really important to be open and to be data driven, and getting the data requires that people report it to you, and you have to actively ask for it as well. You know?
Talk, if you would, we spoke offline, but I really want this here on the show. Talk about your Formula One analogy, if you would.
Yeah, I think that biotech companies are very similar to what you see in the world of Formula One. Formula One, there are 20 of the best drivers are competing on the Formula One weekends. They're racing these cars that are phenomenal pieces of technology built by large teams. To do a pit stop requires 20 to 23 people coordinating everything they do. And the fastest pit stops that have been recorded for this year, 1.9 seconds. That's less than 2 seconds to change all the tires and get the car out of there again once it's stopped. The Formula One analogy is, in a biotech company, you need some top experts on the technical side. You need a culture of communication. You're trying to perform at very, very high levels. Oftentimes, you're gonna do things that have never been done before. You have to be driven by the data and be seeking data that will help you make adjustments and things as you move forward. I think the analogy is extremely strong.
100%. I love it. And it's always boggles my mind when you say, look, my profession is recruiting, right? Our entire existence is to help build teams and build companies and build careers. And it always boggles my mind when you see on a corporation's website that people are our most important asset, or, you know, our people are whatever it says around that. But then you hear, well, our CEO doesn't want us to use recruiters right now because we have to watch our budget and stuff. I'm thinking, wait a minute, is this an expense or is this an investment into the greater greater plan of the organization?
Well, I think that what you have to do when you have a position that needs to be filled, you want to find the best person possible. And oftentimes, even though I would have somebody that was referred to me that I partially knew, I would actually do the executive search to make sure that don't leave any stones unturned, and we can convince ourselves that we're getting the best person possible at that moment to fill that position.
You know? I love that, man. I'm going to make sure that as many people possible hear that, because that's how it should be. Because if you really are trying to get after the best possible, there's too many avenues that can be unturned if you're not exploring different avenues of how to capture that talent's interest. So. Good for you. That's awesome. Listen, I know that you've taken companies public successfully, and you've done this in different capacities. One of them was virtually. You literally took a company IPO virtually, did you not?
Well, yeah. The only company that I've personally taken public was Sarah, actually. And in 2021, on the 15th of July, we took the company public. That IPO was done without a single in-person investor meeting because of the lockdown. You couldn't do it. And people were really worried, can you actually pull this off? As it turned out, it was a great benefit to be able to reach out to people all over the world, to have meetings with anybody that was convenient for them and for you. And we were able to get the IPO done. It was hard to run a company virtually. And I think that was really interesting. I have a technology guy who buttonholed me one day. I was just talking to him about how he was doing. He says, you know, I got this new app. It's called Teams. Okay. And I said, oh, I'll tell him about it. And he showed it to me. I said, can you put it on my phone right now? Yeah. Can we actually do a meeting right now? Yeah. And that was on the 12th of March, 2020. I had just come back from the Cowen conference where by the way, there was COVID spread at that conference as one of the big events that happened in the early days there in early March of 20. And I, as soon as I saw that you could do this, I said, okay, we're locking the company down tomorrow. And we sent a decree out to everybody, pick up your desk, take it home. We're going virtual with the exception of essential employees who must be at work. The people working in the lab, there are a few people that had to be there, but we were able to actually do the lockdown during the pandemic and operate the company very, very well. We had to make a lot of allowances. We had to communicate frequently with people. We had weekly meetings, all hands meetings every week, and talk about what we were doing so everybody knew what was going on. There was a big burden of communication. But in some ways, you got to reach out to people and touch them, and where finding them physically wasn't always possible, you know? And so it was something we adapted to.
What do you think? Was it the communication burden trying to navigate that piece, or was it something else that you see as the biggest challenge during that time leading a company virtually?
I think keeping people on the same page, knowing what we were doing, and making it work was really an important challenge to face. Thankfully, our employees were incredibly productive, and what we had to do was actually help them to balance work-life issues. Because now that they're home with their families, it was very hard for them to separate work from what was going on in the immediate environment. And we had to make allowances for them, you know? So
100%.
There are lots of things you do, you know?
What's your philosophy as it stands today about, because there's a big push in the industry to come back to at least some sort of hybrid capacity, but what's your philosophy on this?
I think that certainly the idea of having people be remote is not new. Sales organizations that cover the country can't be there physically. They just can't. They aren't. And frankly, one of the benefits that you have when you're trying to build a really skilled, high performing team, you can reach out internationally and get people that you need. You can go as broadly as you need to. So my philosophy is, you can make it work, and there are some jobs that must be done on site, and you want to be very respectful of those people, because for them to go in every day and be required to be there physically, it's easy for people to feel resentful of people that aren't there all the time. But if the team understands what it's doing, if the team is achieving its goals, if it's clear what the roles and responsibilities are, that's kind of how you manage it, you know?
Do you think that the IPO, the success of going IPO, was actually expedited by having to be virtual as far as getting people on a meeting?
Yeah, it made it easier to do, easier to schedule. And we had a successful IPO. It was good. But it's never easy. You know, the old way of doing things, going on a 2 to 3 week road trip, a road show where you go out and hit, you know, three to five cities in a day. Sometimes you try and go over to Europe and meet people. It was very, very wearing on people, very difficult. Yeah. We didn't have to put up with that. We could actually focus on getting the information to people. And eventually it became something that a lot of the investors liked. They actually liked the convenience of it, you know?
I bet. I've got a twofold question for you. The first part is, as CEO, what do you think, what's the toughest decision that you've ever had to make?
Okay. I thought long and hard about this question because you and I talked about it earlier. I think that to me, the hardest decisions that you make are the personal decisions that affect people. Okay. Those are the hardest ones. So let me give you an example. Let's say that you start out and you have a person that has responsibility for a certain area. Okay. And they're able to perform it. But as the company grows and scales, then it actually surpasses their capabilities and you need to bring somebody else in. Now, to be fair to this person, they were there for a long time. They put in a lot of work. They did a great job for a period of time. But at some point, the company surpassed where they could go. And to me, the hardest part was finding out how to make a transition for that person and to bring somebody else in. That was always the hardest thing. And you have to do that. As companies move forward in time, they can't be static. And you need to make sure the company has what it needs, but you also have to be extremely fair to the people who have served so capably for so long and make sure that you help them to get their next position. I think that's one of the hardest things of all. Now, there are other hard decisions that you can make in a company. For example, let's say the decision is, let's run a trial of this size, and this is what we expect the results to be. And then you say, okay, that's great. What if we were to actually increase the size of the trial? Would we have more information? Would it be better information? Are there more things we could look at? And what would you do? If you act, one of the things I like to talk to people about is you need a North Star. A North Star is a point you're navigating toward. And if your goal is to improve the well-being of patients, which is a very good, solid North Star for biotech companies, then you ask the question, if I spend more money, will you actually improve the well-being of patients more? And how much? You have to estimate what that benefit is going to be. And it sometimes, when you're conflicted between choice A and choice B, when you ask that question, it becomes clear which one is going to be the better choice. And so I think those are hard decisions. Not every decision you make is going to work out. You always make decisions under uncertainty. You have to be able to give it your best shot, be informed by data, and then at the end of the day, you make a decision to move. And that's what you have to do.
There's a lot to unpack there. The first piece is, I'm glad you brought that up about the company almost outgrowing the individual. We go back to the idea of a cabinet. You know, what was a great person, a really strong individual in that position at that time made sense. As the company scales, it's not that skill set. You need somebody else. That's got to be a hard move because that person put in blood, sweat, and tears for you.
It's really hard. And you develop a rapport with them. You work hard with them. You solve problems with them. You've been, it's kind of like band of brothers. You've been comrades in arms and you've seen a lot and done a lot together. It's very hard. But what you want to do, the best way to separate is to really make sure they have all the support they need and you get them to where they need to go next. That's what you have to do to be kind and understanding and to move it forward. But you have to make those choices sometimes, you know?
Well, and the other piece to it is I wanted to push back on you a little bit. And you said, hey, you've got to have a North Star. And usually the North Star is what's the greater good for the patient. If we make a decision against the fact that it's for the greater good of the patient, we're usually on the right track. What happens when money's tight and there's calculated risk, right? And you need more funding. And it's because it's for the greater good of trying to develop the product. But investors are like, now it's too much risk. Well, there's got to be some conflict there, I would think.
There is conflict. And you bring up a very good point. And sometimes you have to go to the investors and articulate to them why it's in their best interest to do best for the patient, because that will actually build a stronger company. And sometimes you have to go out and raise more money to in order to do that. And it's not easy. Yeah. And especially, as we know today, it's very hard to raise money. The markets are pretty tough for that. But sometimes in order to get somewhere, you have to have the capital to be able to execute it. It's like if you want to build a high performing vehicle, you got to be able to put gas in it. And the energy, the gas you put into a vehicle is in fact the funding that you have to run your company.
I love sometimes how the flow between myself and the guest I have just kind of goes naturally, because I was going to ask you about that. You've raised money in different environments. What is your take on what's going on today?
Oh, what's going on today?
What your opinion of what's going on with investing and, you know, where?
Well, I think that it's really an interesting question. And I'll tell you how I've navigated it and continue to try and navigate it. What you do when you have a new technology, you have to ask yourself, how's it going to be used? What is the current status quo? And is it actually materially better than current status quo? If it is, then what you do is you build careful, thoughtful economic models that show what the benefit is, and you can capture that. And ultimately, that will be translated into value, and you're able to charge a price for the service or the technology that you're offering to people. So to me, if you think about it in very careful economic terms, you want to show clinical benefit by improving health. And you also want to show that ideally you want to actually show that there's economic benefit achieved through improving health. It lowers healthcare costs. It's better for everybody. that's a good direction to go when you're building new technologies.
Yeah. What do you think is going to be the catalyst to kind of loosen up some of the money in the market?
Well, I think that, you know, there are a lot of macro things going on. A lot of conflicts around the world. There are challenges with interest rates right now. I mean, there are lots of things, but we all know the things cycle. We've been through several nuclear winters that have occurred, and things rebound over time. And I think it's just, luckily we live in a place where there's an interest in creating new things, better things. And if you have something that's materially better, I think that's a way to actually get funding that you need that will make a difference. And so you have to be able to articulate that. You have to be able to tell that story and convince people why investing in your enterprise is going to help them as investors, because it's going to help patients get better. You know?
Yeah, I asked that question because I feel like it's been really tough in med tech and biotech, and money really has tightened up, not dried up, but tightened. And I feel like it's been this whole snowball since COVID, where there was an influx of hiring, then interest rates went up, investors got spooked, they were tighter with their money, large strategics are laying off. It's just this whole kind of storm, it seems, in our industry that hopefully is going to resolve itself quickly.
Well, there are still investments being made. Not at the magnitude they were, but they're still being made. There's still good ideas that people have. And so these things, again, to be philosophical, these things do cycle. And so hopefully we'll get into a better spot. The more companies that are created that actually show value and work, the more investors are likely to invest in those kinds of companies. And that's the other thing. Many investors have actually focused on things that they're interested in. They're looking at shorter term returns rather than longer term returns. That also changes the profile of the kind of people that you want to attract to a new technology. Yeah.
You know, the second part of that question I wanted to ask is, I asked you what your toughest decision that you've had to make as a CEO is. The other piece to this is somebody who's becoming a first-time CEO. Somebody who's been an executive, you know, at the VP level, let's say, is becoming the first time CEO, or they're a COO, they're becoming the CEO, whatever it may be.
Yeah.
What are they in for that they're not going to be expecting as far as some of the challenges?
That's a great question. I'll tell you an anecdote that illustrates what happens. I was president of a diagnostic division at Myriad. I had responsibility for everything that happened in that division. When I left, after I retired from Myriad back in 2010, I decided that I was going to go work with a bunch of companies and venture companies. And when I got into Sera as an example, it was a new company. They were all the first fundraise that we did was about $19.3 million, a big Series A, and from that we actually launched a study to discover and validate a prediction of preterm birth, because prematurity affects approximately 10% of U.S. pregnancies. It causes billions of dollars of expense, and there are short and long-term complications that occur. So when we did that, the company had four, arguably five people initially. That's it. There wasn't anything. There were no procedures built. There was nothing. And I remember a year after that, I went back to Pete Meldrum, who was the CEO at Myriad. I took him out to breakfast. I said, Pete, This breakfast is in honor of what I now know you had to go through to build Myriad to get to where it got. I said, I had no idea about all these things. You've got all kinds of procedures to do. You've got all kinds of requirements for accounting. There are just tons of little things that you have to pay attention to as you build a company, and you have to get people to help you. And in many ways, when you start out, it's all hands on deck. And it's a lot of work for everybody. You know?
Yeah. Do you think it truly is lonelier at the top?
I think that there are times of loneliness for sure, because at the end of the day, you are responsible for everything that happens in the company, and you could try and pass off blame and on other people, but at the end of the day, you chose them, You put them in place. It's what you're building. So I think that it does get lonely at times, and making sure that you stay grounded, don't lose perspective of where you're going. It's an important thing to pay attention to. You know, you can also talk to other CEOs, and sometimes that's useful. You can talk to your mentors, and you can talk to your board. So there are people that can help when you have these feelings of loneliness, help you get through those times as you move forward. But at the end of the day, the buck does stop with you.
It's a big weight to carry a lot of times, which begs the question, with all the stress, how do you manage the stress and how do you keep a personal life and kind of try and create the quote unquote balance, if you will?
Yeah, I try and spend time with family. I was being interviewed once for going in for a minor procedure, and the intake nurse said, do you use any recreational drugs? And I said, yes. I said, I use exercise. That's what it is.
That's awesome.
I think staying fit is really a part of this job, honestly. And any CEO has a tremendous burden to stay healthy as they can, to stay ready. So that's part of the balance, spending time with friends and family, people, loved ones. That's also part of it. You have to have some ways of relaxing. I like to listen to music, and I like to do some reading and listen to different languages and stuff. I think there are lots of things that you can do to have fun and to sort of disengage for a little. But as a CEO, you're carrying that burden all the time. You wake up thinking about things.
I was just going to ask you, can you actually turn it off?
No, but you can turn the volume down and put your attention on other things. One of the reasons that many CEOs like to drive race cars, I don't drive them because I just don't have time to do it. But one of the reasons they do that is because it's the only time where your attention has to be 150% on what you're doing at that moment. And so finding something like that is really a useful thing to sort of really be able to disengage, you know?
Wow, that makes a lot of sense, actually, a lot of sense. Man, you're a wealth of knowledge, and I commend you for all the accolades that you've achieved over the years and all the positive influence you've had on others around you. I want to talk for a minute before we wrap here about this nonprofit that you're involved with, Bear Lake Watch. Tell us about it.
Yeah. Yeah, Bear Lake Watch is a nonprofit organization dedicated to keeping Bear Lake clean, deep, and blue. Bear Lake is a lake that's split between Idaho and Utah. It's 109 square miles, a very beautiful lake at nearly 6,000 feet elevation. A Caribbean blue color because of the calcium carbonate crystals that are in the lake. It's a place for recreation. It's used for irrigation. It's multi-use. And what I'm doing with Bear Lake Watch is actually helping to address the changes that occur as the lake has been discovered. A lot of people love spending time there. The visits have gone up enormously, more than 300% in the last several years. And with that, it brings all the problems of development, of people, and everything else. It begins putting stress on the lake. And so one of the things that we're seeing is invasive species of plants that have never been in the lake before. We're starting to see them, and they're brought in by boats and they begin spreading. And so one of the things that we're doing is actually sponsoring a symposium where we have the 14 of the world's top plant scientists and organizations that are dedicated toward aquatic plants involved in helping us to put a plan together. And the plan has to involve both states, has to involve the public, has to involve everybody. And we're excited to be working on stuff like that. We actually collect money every year as an organization from a golf tournament, and the funds go into supporting research grants by various scientists. 13 grants have been funded. There are 8 that are currently underway. It's very exciting to see this work happening, you know.
Wow, that's amazing. And I can hear that you're very passionate about it, which is awesome. What a great cause, too. Keep that lake clean and healthy. And it reminds me when I was a kid, very little, probably 5 years old, we had a beach that we used to go to. And it was a gorgeous lake.
Yep.
And within like a year, it was beer cans and LG, and it was just it was taken over. You couldn't use the lake anymore. So
this is what happens. And you know, it's interesting in learning about this and being involved. 75% of Americans spend time at the beach for their vacation. 75%.
Wow.
It involves lakes, rivers, and ocean. You just think about it. We're drawn to water, and water is so important. And so, to me, it's another way of we want to keep the environment healthy. We want to be proactive and do things that will make it better for everybody, so they're going to leave a good legacy. So that's the involvement there.
That's awesome. Well, listen, Dr. Gregory Critchfield, everybody, I really appreciate all the nuggets that you've dropped today. Last but not least, what's next for Early Diagnostics?
Well, Early Diagnostics, we have a technology that was invented by our scientific founder, Jasmine Zhou, at UCLA. She's a professor of pathology there. She and her team have found a way to analyze the methylome, comprehensively analyze the methylome. That's the methyl groups get attached to a portion of DNA, one of the bases, and they can actually switch genes off and alter the expression of genes. And with her work, she was one of the first people to report out that she could detect cancer in blood and tell you what cancer it is from just a blood test. So this is the kind of work that we're engaged in. Very exciting stuff. All the companies that I've had the pleasure of working in, and by the way, you talked about awards and things. The awards are really a reflection of all the people that I've been able to work with over the years. There are a lot of people that deserve, they're so deserving of the credit to help build things. They're dedicated scientists, dedicated workers. They go to work every day wanting to make the world a better place. It's a fantastic industry to be working in.
Amazing. Well spoken, like a true leader, humble as ever. So nothing but continued success to you, to the team. What amazing stuff is going on in that company. And again, can't thank you enough for being here and sharing your wisdom today. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mitch. And we'll be in touch.
Thanks for listening to the MedTech Talent Lab podcast. For more content-rich episodes, log on to theanthonymichaelgroup.com or subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast platform.